You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur, your host for Innovation for Alpha, and I am joined today by a very special guest, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark, who, if I read her resume, we would be concluding the podcast by the time I finish. She has got so many interesting things in her background. But Dr. Mark, welcome to the show.
Tobin, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's going to be fun just getting to know you more. Every time I learn something about you, it just opens up more doors. But maybe let's start out with as much of a synopsis as possible on your background, maybe starting with your medical, you know, training and early career and then up to the present.
Yes. So going back many moons ago, I am a physician. I trained in endocrinology, but especially in reproductive endocrinology, also geriatrics, and I created our country's first women's health fellowship at the University of California, San Francisco, then became the senior medical advisor to HHS, the Office of Women's Health, worked with the Surgeon General, and then also worked with NASA for over 18 years, and then had the privilege to work at the White House in the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And in between all that, I created a for-profit boutique consultancy called Solomed Solutions. So I get to provide scientific and strategic direction to corporations, organizations, and agencies across the globe and across the U.S. And I also created a nonprofit, and everything has acronyms in Washington. So it's called iGiant, and it stands for the Impact of Gender and Sex on Innovation, Novel Technologies. And we're really the only nonprofit accelerator for gendered innovation across health, IT, transportation, and retail sectors.
So let's unpack that just first. So when explain that a little bit. So what's the mission of the goal kind of in a little bit more detail?
Yes. So the mission of iGiant is to accelerate the translation of research into sex and gender-specific design elements. So let me explain what that all means. A design element can be a product, a policy, a protocol, and a program. And then the definitions of sex and gender we take from the National Academy of Sciences. So sex tends to be the biological construct. Gender is more the psychosocial. We know that everything seems interconnected these days, especially with the role of epigenetics. So as we interact with the environment interacts with our genes. But we use these terms, sex, gender, to kind of help define where we are. And our vision is pretty simple, but very profound, and that's to improve the safety and quality of life for everyone in every environment, and including in the work environment. So we have a very broad stance. We take a non-binary approach, but it's really certainly critical. You know, as we talk about health equity, the only way we can actually achieve it is if we ensure that everybody's given the resources and opportunities and tools to do their jobs well and safely, to live well and safely.
Give an example, if there's a simple one that comes to mind, just to kind of illustrate the types of things that you're looking at.
Absolutely. So iGiant has a toolkit. And in our toolkit, we have roundtables and summits, which is especially a roundtable. And these roundtables provide awareness. They empower individuals to be ambassadors, to go back to their respective organizations. And there are also opportunities to share best practices. And before I start, really the exponential experiential component of a roundtable, I ask questions such as, has anyone ever had a drug side effect? And almost invariably, everybody has said yes. And so we know that men and women metabolize drugs very differently. I also believe that vaccine dosages need to be altered. We're doing that for age. We see this smaller dose for younger individuals, older individuals tend to get a larger dose. But we also know that sex and gender can influence that as well. And so we see, for example, more side effects in women. So perhaps the dose could be a bit smaller because women have really robust immune systems. Another area that's so fascinating is the issue of IT. We know men and women process information very differently. So we see increased burnout, for example, among clinicians when they use electronic health record, because the programs are really designed for the way a male brain operates. We also see increased repetitive stress injuries in women compared to men, because women have greater tactile sensation. So they think they're pressing down on the device, but the device isn't registering it. So imagine, you know, the world we live in today, 24/7, we're attached to all our devices. We sleep with them, not only on the bedside, but in the bed these days, because they're just so connected to us. But pushing down on these devices day in and day out, we're actually seeing increased repetitive stress disorders in women. Car injuries, you know, we have seen 47% more likely chance of having a more severe neck injury for women. Neck musculature is less. The way women are positioned in the seat of the car influences it. So we can do better in car design. And then the other is retail. And this one was actually really fascinating. We've seen this in the pandemic. And I just published an opinion piece in The Hill in early, it was mid-February. Okay. And it was looking at respirators and face masks. And they're not designed for anyone that is not an average-sized Caucasian European male and clean-shaven male. So we know we can do better. It's just that we haven't done it until often we're really pushed against the wall.
That makes a lot of sense. In some ways, it sounds like some of the things we talk about in personalized medicine, which is the fact that we're not all genetically the same. And so therefore, any drug, any nutritional application is not going to impact us the same way. And given computing power and lots of advances, there are things that we can do better for sure. You touch on, just by describing what you do, is a lot of what I would, you know, look at as public-private partnerships. And we've talked a little bit about this. Talk a little bit about some of the things you've learned in terms of how can we get better socially, societally, in working with government, because it's not an us against them kinds of a situation. Government pays for half of our healthcare, on and on and on. There's lots of reasons, but what are some of your experiences and thoughts on public-private partnerships and how we can improve on those?
I think public-private partnerships are absolutely essential. This is really where you get the cutting edge of technology, because keep in mind, the shareholder for the government is us, the taxpayer. And we tend to have a longer lag time before we want the return on our investment compared to what we see in the private sector corporate environment. So, for example, when you look at healthcare, we have many different examples. I worked at HHS for many years, and I'll give you the name of one program. It was Missiles to Mammograms. We knew that conventional mammography was very old, outdated, over 40, 50 years old, misses a lot of breast masses, overreads breast masses. So we needed more sensitive and specific technology. And so what we did is we partnered with NASA and the CIA and the Department of Defense to start using some of their technology. The neural networks, for example, so that you could image where you're going to launch missiles. The Hubble telescope uses important silicon chips, and we could incorporate that into digital mammography. So we began doing that. And now today, exactly that. We have digital mammography. We have ability to image breast tissue more specifically and in a more sensitive manner and hopefully less invasively. So again, that's a wonderful example. The NIH, National Institutes of Health, they have the Center for Translational Sciences, and there they're trying to bridge that so-called valley of death, which can mean that it could take many years, over 15 years and billions of dollars, and then some of these wonderful ideas just die and they fall into that valley. So now with some assistance from the government, we can move these ideas from concept to actually products.
I love it. And you mentioned NASA. Just maybe touch on some of your experience at NASA. How did you get involved in that to begin with? What was the pull?
Well, I think like all of us, products of the Apollo age, again, dating how old I am, but I'm so grateful actually that I got to see human beings walk on the moon. And I still remember that. And I think for some of us who are listening to this, we remember that moment in time because it was really inspirational. And for that moment, I knew I wanted to be an astronaut. Fortunately, no one told me that women weren't part of the astronaut corps until the 1970s. So I was able to continue with my delusion that I could be an astronaut. But the wonderful part of this is that if you have dreams, you can make things a reality. And I actually became an astronaut finalist. So I had an opportunity to begin working with NASA on some of my other areas that I'm passionate about. And again, that's issues of health equity. Mm-hmm. And I joined NASA as a senior medical advisor to help move that along. And so it was just an extraordinary opportunity because I was part of the space shuttle program and then began to see as we transitioned from the shuttle to the International Space Station and then beginning to put the roadmap in for Artemis to go to the moon and working with other groups to envision going to Mars. You have to set your sights high. So it's just been, for me, an extraordinary experience. And one of the other things that I did do for them was public health preparedness. So, for example, at the time we were dealing with Ebola, I was working with NASA as well as the White House. And I got to see that public health issue from many different perspectives. But to see the translation of technology from NASA to improve what we were doing for treating and caring for Ebola was fascinating, from everything from remote sensors to robotics to protective equipment. So it's just been an extraordinary journey to have these really incredible experiences.
That's pretty neat. And I imagine you, as a result of those, interact with some incredible people with just intelligence and passion and all kinds of characters.
I love the word characters. Absolutely. I have a book. It's called Stellar Medicine, A Journey Through the Universe of Women's Health. It's a part memoir, part guidebook on controversial health issues. And I look at the political, the economic, the psychosocial constructs which shape our decisions. But what I love about it, because it's part memoir, every chapter has a space focus. So I get to talk about some of my friends and colleagues. And to this day, we're in touch. We are constantly in touch. We've been through the pandemic, through all our life's experiences, because they're some of the most brilliant people I've ever met. They just see the world so uniquely. And they are so, I don't want to say risk averse, because it doesn't really allude to what they do, but it's just a balanced view of what we need to do. It's that risk benefit equation that's constantly measured in space exploration, as well as our life here on this planet.
Any interest, by the way, of ever jumping on the Bezos expeditions or one of those interplanetary?
Absolutely. If you asked me today, I would be there in 5 seconds and I would carry the Angel MD banner because we can bring it to space.
I love it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the exciting part for me, is to see the commercial space sector really democratize space exploration. I've talked to some of my colleagues in that world, and one of the issues that we do need to do is to ensure that the public can connect to it, because right now it seems to be the wealthy person's adventure.
Right.
And again, it had its very foundation in the government. We've paid for some of this.
Yeah.
So I would really love to see that we do a really good job providing sort of that corporate social responsibility component and bring commercial space to everybody who is on this planet. I think that would be a benefit, and also to find ways to bring individuals into space who may not have $55 million to be able to do it.
Speaking of space, just while we're on that topic, you had mentioned some initiatives here in Colorado, which has a big space presence. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe just mention a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I am a proud third generation Coloradan, and I am so excited to see what Colorado has really pioneered. It's really the largest commercial space sector in the world. And there's the Colorado Space Business Roundtable. We had Alaire Salmon, who was the president for the Colorado Space Business Roundtable, as a board member for my nonprofit. And I've had the privilege again to provide a keynote to that group and to run a challenge competition and do a roundtable. It's really exciting, because I think what we see here is when you bring these type of new innovative technology sectors together, they amplify. And I just see Colorado is just, you know, truly the front range of where we're going in the space program.
I love that endorsement. While we're on the public side of things, public sector, your White House work, you know, for most people, they'll never have access to the kinds of things that you've done there. And so when you say working with the White House, give us an example of what that looks like. Is that briefings? Is that committee meetings? I mean, what is the process of working with the White House look like for somebody at any given time?
Yes. So again, I was with the White House 2014, 2015 as a senior policy advisor. So I actually got to go over to the White House compound. And at the time, we actually worked in offices. And I have to say that every moment that I walked through those gates, I was so proud to be able to work at the White House. There's just something about our history and about the importance of what we were doing, because it had impact just so far and wide. Most people know that iGiant, my nonprofit, actually had its genesis in the White House. And I always tell people we were given advanced technology to put our ideas down, and that was a whiteboard. We were given a chalkboard. Each of us had a chalkboard. We had chalk and eraser. And I had to laugh because we would develop these wonderful ideas and then at the end of the meeting erase it. So in that sense, you were never hacked. The old-fashioned technology, no leaks, exactly. The old-fashioned technology. So I developed the blueprint for my nonprofit on a chalkboard, which was great because it allowed me to go back to that childlike ambition that I think all of us still have. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to be a bit creative. So I created iGiant because I saw what was happening with Ebola. People, especially women, were getting infected when they were donning and doffing their protective equipment. Mm. We were also working on the Precision Medicine Initiative at the time. And so to me, the low-hanging fruit was looking at the human factor of sex and gender. And that's how I began to develop the blueprint for iGiant. I think what's exciting about the White House is that you have access to meet with so many interesting people all over the world, and we had extraordinary briefings. And the other part of it is it's the people's house. So every day, people far and wide would come, and they would share their ideas and their concepts, and we would have this wonderful mutual exchange. I also have to say it's a 24/7 job. It's absolutely exhausting. I think being a doc prepares you for that because we're all on call. We used to be on call all the time. So it was just an extraordinary experience and one that I truly treasure.
That's pretty neat. So just walk us chronologically. You finish up that stint. Then where did you head after that? Was it starting to build iGiant? Was that the next piece or?
Well, I think, Tobin, for my life, I've never really done anything that was sequential. They all tend to be at the same time. So let me backtrack even further. So when I was in my fellowships, I started off with general endocrinology after I did my internal medicine residency, and then got so fascinated with reproductive endocrinology. So I began working with the repro endo group at UCSF as well. And then I realized I was really fascinated by the health of older women. And at that time, that was women over the age of 50, which I now realize is absurd.
That's the new 30.
It's exactly. So it was rather funny how, you know, in your mind's eye, when you are 30, what you think is old.
Right.
And so I became a geriatrics fellow as well. And then as I started to put the dots together, I realized, you know, we can't do things by our reproductive status. There really has to be an integrated, holistic view of it. And I began putting into place what later became a women's health fellowship. And so I was doing research and clinical care for many, many different divisions at UCSF. So I was working with radiology department, cardiology, general endocrine, OBGYN, repro endo, geriatrics. So it just, you know, truly multi-specialty. And just on call, again, 24/7. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of the pre having a cell phone that you could actually fit in your pocket. It was more what you could put in a backpack.
Right.
So, in quarters, lots of quarters to make some phone calls. So that was the world back then. But it was really, for me, a wonderful lesson in how to prioritize time and how to foster collaboration and to seek connection. And then I had this idea that we needed to create national centers of excellence in women's health, where these were multidisciplinary centers that provided clinical care and research and education and outreach and career development. So as a young fellow, I pitched the idea to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Health at HHS from my call room. And she liked it. She was coming out to California, and I briefed her, and literally in 15 minutes, my life changed because she said, we'll bring you to Washington to do it on a nationwide scale. And I was really fortunate that UCSF gave me a faculty appointment. I just finished my fellowship to allow me to come to Washington to do this. And, you know, you get this so-called Potomac fever. And I ended up staying because when you get to create programs and you get to scale them up to such huge dimensions, it's really exciting. And that's just sort of the nature of what I do. If I see something that hasn't been created, I try to create a blueprint. And then I try to find people who can help make that a possibility and a reality. And I think that's what we all do in many ways. So over the journey, HHS, NASA, I worked at NASA the same time as HHS, and then decided I wanted to work more closely with companies. And I created SolarMed Solutions. And then while I was at the White House, I was working also with NASA and became the medical director for Ogilvy. Because we needed to ensure communications. So it's just the nature. I think all of us multitask. Very few of us get to do just one thing, but there's richness in it. It's exhausting, right. But there's richness in it because you get to connect all the partners you work with.
Well, let's touch on the other group that you just referenced, and that's the commercial side of the house, industry. Mm-hmm. And obviously there are huge R&D budgets on that side of the world, whether it's pharma or device or what have you. So walk a little bit through your experience working with industry, and then we'll touch a little bit on how industry and the public sector can work more effectively together.
Yes. So I've had the opportunity to work with Fortune 5 companies, some of the world's largest companies, and some of our startups, both in the pharmaceutical world as well as the medical device sector. And I think what has been fascinating for me is that I watch ideas go from preconception to development to actual out to the public. And I think along that spectrum, you see where there are roadblocks and landmines that need to be crossed and bypassed. And then some wonderful ideas just simply die on the vine. I think we've talked about it, where they're phenomenal concepts, but they're just not viable because they're just not feasible, whether they're too expensive or they really don't meet the need of the marketplace. Right. So I think it's really important in the preconception phase that that exercise is performed. It can probably save a lot of time, money, dollars.
Yep.
And I think the other part of it is early on, start to think about your potential partners. I work across multiple stakeholders, so certainly industry, but also government and NGOs and advocacy, and the academic center. Academic centers are a very rich treasure trove for brilliant incubators and accelerators, and try to engage them as well. But you really have to see who is your audience and how are you going to market to them, and then how do you make this viable so that it can survive in the marketplace?
Do you see this trend, or have you, been involved in this, where industry seems to be doing less internal R&D and instead looking at the market, i.e. startups, and more actively acquiring them, letting them effectively be the external R&D, and as they see things that are building traction, acquiring them? I mean, have you witnessed that, and what are your thoughts on, the opportunity there for entrepreneurs and others to know that ultimately industry is treating the market like that?
I do see that. And it's not to say that there is an independent R&D within industry, but yes, sure, that acquisition phase. And I've often talked with a lot of startups where that's their goal. They just want to have an exit. They want to find that larger partner to scale up their concepts. I certainly could appreciate that. I think, again, as we know, it takes a considerable amount of revenue to bring an idea from concept to development to actual production phase.
Yep.
I think if you could work in tandem, maybe a greater collaboration at the start could be very effective. So I know a lot of companies will go to incubators and help to mature ideas, bring it to fruition, guide them. So I think that's valuable. I think the hardest part is when startups invest so much time and effort. And if they really did the right thing early on, they would know whether it was something that was really viable and would survive, or just to exit off and start something new. So there, that's where the guidance comes in.
Yeah. And we see with the NIH and companies that come through NIH programs, in particular, they're very good at that. They've adopted the lean startup methodology that Steve Blank popularized, and they really spend a lot of time up front on that, product market fit, to the point where they don't have the mindset of build it and they will come. They want to figure out, is somebody willing to pay a dollar for this thing I'm building? Because if they're not, this is probably not going anywhere. And so, ironically, the government has done a very good job in their programs at the NIH, as I mentioned, whereas a lot of other incubators and others may not necessarily pay attention to that marketability or that commercialization. It's sort of a cool, shiny widget, and then they hope something right. comes of that later. As you look forward, and you know, is as obvious when people listen to you, you do have your hands in a number of different pots. They're interconnected. As you start to learn more about what you're doing, there's a rhyme to the reason. But over the next year, 2 years, what are the things that you're particularly passionate about? What does success look like for you, you know, if you look back 24 months from now?
So is that important question? And I think I've told you, I tend to see my world through the prism of space using a sex gender lens. Mm-hmm. So I think all of us have guiding principles. And once you follow that, that even if you go on many different tangents, you still have your direction of where you're heading. For me, I have this nonprofit and we have a really exciting toolkit. As I mentioned, we have roundtables and summits. We've also created a seal of approval for design processes so that companies can use the seal to actually foster expanded commercialization. We have other areas that we work with, such as challenge competitions. And I think for everyone who's worked a challenge competition, again, some of the issues we talked about are important. The viability of the concept, how innovative is it, how disruptive is it, and how viable, how feasible is it to actually develop and implement? Mm-hmm. So for my goal with the iGiant, I want an accelerator. For the accelerator, I've certainly seen during this pandemic, we need that. Mm-hmm. We have had over 100 events and 5 challenges, and we have corporate advisory councils. But to actually have that accelerator to get companies to take these ideas to marketplace. So, and it's important. I think in order to actually have innovation, you need to ensure that you're seeing it through the various, what I call human factor lens. Are mm-hmm. you looking at sex, gender, age, race? And that improves, it mitigates the economic, the legal, the financial challenges that one will face. And it improves employer, employee, client satisfaction, it improves the market share, and it really expands innovation. So for that, I think that's one driving goal. The other, and we've talked about this, is the communication, finding really wonderful platforms to be able to share our messages mm-hmm. and do it in a way that is clear and consistent with all the facts that you know. So that's extraordinarily important. And then the other part of it is that tech transfer element and to work in sectors that haven't been traditionally touched to expand what we're doing in healthcare. So reaching out to some of our partners in space and intelligence and in military and sort of the unusual suspects to bring them into the marketplace to expand healthcare. I mean, we talk about it in government. We have DARPA, we have eARPA. There's now a new initiative to work at it from health. And I think that's where I see that public-private partnership really expand. But we individually in our own efforts can do that. So whenever I work with clients, I always think about potential government partners that should be brought in to either provide advice or guidance or actually see about partnerships.
That's neat. Speaking of human-centered design, have mm-hmm. you worked with some of the design firms? Because I think of, for example, IDEO, one of the leading firms, and that concept of human-centered design seems like it's embedded yeah. in most of what they do. Are these groups that you've also interacted with in your various projects?
Yes, yes, they're important. So we did a design summit at Google before the pandemic, and we had some really interesting partners on board there. And I think many companies actually have a design component. It's just they often are not brought into the table at the start, and I think that's difficult. So if you're not actually looking at the user interface until the very end, it's much more expensive and more time consuming to actually go back in and redesign. So I really think at the start, they need to be as part of the discussion to be at the table.
Yeah, that makes sense. Speaking of Google and space, my co-founder, Jens Francis, I'm going to pick on him a little bit. He's one of my favorite people in the world, but he's a member, might even be a board member of SETI. So looking for extraterrestrial mm-hmm. life, where do you come down on this topic? Is there life out there or is there not?
It's so funny you brought that up. I was cleaning my boxes yesterday. Finally, you know, did that after so many years of letting everything be in piles. And I found an article I wrote, and it was after the Kepler found that we have some of our exoplanets that are just perfect for life. That Goldilocks effect is just right. And I actually wrote an article that was published, and I talked about it being the universal driver, that as we find life outside our own little planetary system here, we will all become human. We will all become one. We won't be divided by geographic, geopolitical boundaries and other social determinants that divide us. We will all be human beings or earthlings. So yes, I think there is. I mean, there's zillions of stars. And for all these stars, we have incredible number of planets. So why wouldn't there be? It may not be in the way that we recognize it, but
fair enough.
I also think we're all aliens. We're all made of stardust from the beginning of time. So we are actually the aliens.
That might be a sci-fi novel. another list on your resume.
Oh my goodness. We will be very busy. Lots to write about.
Lots to write about. Well, let's wrap it up there. I think we definitely need to have many subsequent discussions where we can go down any number of these things in more detail, but it's a great introductory piece. And I hope that everyone watching, listening, continues to lean in and listen. We're going to put in the show notes links to iGiant and any other programs that you would like to highlight, including talks that you give, your book, and invite people to lean in, learn more, and more to come. So Dr. Mark, thank you so much for spending time today on the show.
Tobin, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And I just hope everybody reaches for their own stars.
Well, and while you're doing that, we are looking forward to getting you back to Colorado and bringing you home as a native.
Absolutely. My bags are packed.
Thank you.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.